Hello and welcome to today's edition of the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. World, Middle East. U.S. retaliates against Iran for Tuesday's surprise attack. Trump had vowed earlier to strike Iran for missile attack on U.S. forces in Jordan by Lara Seligman, Philip Wegman, and Vera Bergen-Gruen. American forces began launching strikes against Iran on Wednesday night in what the U.S. military called a powerful response to Iran's Tuesday missile attack on U.S. forces in Jordan. The strikes came hours after President Trump vowed to retaliate for the surprise ballistic missile strike, dashing hopes for an imminent diplomatic breakthrough. "We are going to be hitting them very hard," Trump said in the Oval Office on Wednesday, "because it's our turn." Trump told reporters that the Iranians had been pleading with him not to retaliate in the hours after the attack. But they nevertheless took a shot and now know it's coming. "A counterstrike was inevitable," he said. "Will I always hit back? Pretty much." While Tuesday's missile attack was successfully intercepted, the barrage intensified pressure on the president to respond and threatened to once again restart hostilities as the war with Iran enters its sixth month. The attack shattered a fragile pause that followed Trump's decision to halt a 13-day bombing campaign in hopes of reviving negotiations. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met with Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth in Washington on Wednesday as the Trump administration weighed its next move. In a White House meeting on Tuesday, Trump and Netanyahu did what a senior Israeli official called a clinical review of three strategies toward Iran: a diplomatic agreement, intensifying economic pressure, and ramping up the blockade or renewing military action. U.S. and Israeli officials weighed costs and timelines for each. Netanyahu didn't express a preference for any of the options and told Trump it was his decision, the Israeli official said. He told Trump that diplomacy could be pursued alongside greater economic pressure, such as restricting Iran's overland trade routes while negotiations continue. Hours after the Iranian strike on Jordan, which took place early Wednesday local time, the U.S. military said that American and Saudi aircraft launched strikes against the Iran-backed group in Iraq. And on to our next story. Technology, artificial intelligence. Meta stumbles as tech investors demand better answers on AI spending. Meta fell and Microsoft rallied after sending very different signals on how they're monetizing their massive AI outlays, by Megan Bobrowski. The unconditional love phase of Wall Street's AI romance is over. As Meta platforms learned Wednesday and as Alphabet's Google saw last week, investors want better answers if they're going to keep underwriting hundreds of billions of dollars worth of investments in data centers and development of artificial intelligence models. But when they do see evidence of AI spending yielding returns, they're still prepared to be generous. Microsoft, which reported earnings Wednesday, got a 9% boost in after-hours trading after announcing record and accelerating revenue in its Azure cloud business. Meta shares, meanwhile, shed as much as 10% of their value after hours, erasing more than $140 billion in market value as investors tuned into the company's second quarter earnings call and waited in vain for Chief Executive Mark Zuckerberg to offer new details on how the company plans to make money selling enterprise AI tools or computing capacity. Nor did they hear the specifics they sought on what capital expenditures might look like next year. "We were sort of hoping we'd get something on reselling their excess compute capacity, but they didn't have anything new there," said Mark Mahaney, managing director at Evercore ISI. "The core of the business is doing great, but because of the scale of the investment cycle, the market wants monetization data points beyond just the core business, and they didn't really get them," it didn't help that Meta disclosed more than $2 billion in liabilities from legal proceedings. The company recently settled a social media harm lawsuit with a school district in Kentucky and is facing thousands of other suits, with several slated to go to trial this year. One red line Meta didn't cross, barely, was the border into negative free cash flow. Analysts had predicted the company would go there for the first time since 2012, but it managed to eke out $784 million, a precipitous drop from the previous quarter's $12.4 billion. It was Google's descent into negative free cash flow and simultaneous adjustment of its 2026 capital expenditures forecast to a new range extending above $200 billion that sparked a 7% sell-off in its shares following its earnings call last week. Chief Financial Officer Anat Ashkenazi amped up the unease by making ominous noises about how long cash flow, long a pillar of strength for what had been asset-light, high-margin internet giants, would remain under pressure. The silver lining for Google investors was the company's cloud unit, which recorded scorching revenue growth of 82%, fueled by insatiable demand for computing capacity for training and running AI models. Analysts on Meta's earnings call were audibly eager to hear an update from Zuckerberg on his company's vague plans to stand up a cloud service. Zuckerberg has said Meta can afford to be aggressive on building data center capacity, knowing it can find takers for whatever it has left over after fulfilling its own needs for model development, content optimization, ad targeting, and the like. But on the call, Zuckerberg stuck to generalities. "We have quite a number of offers at a meaningful premium over what we paid for the compute," he said, but didn't specify who the customers might be or announce a timeline for deals. Nor did Meta give more visibility into its capital expenditures beyond raising the floor on its 2026 estimated range by $5 billion to $130 billion. The ceiling stayed put at $145 billion, and finance chief Susan Lee declined to answer a question about 2027. "I think everyone was asking, why don't we have more of a concrete plan?" Brent Thill, a tech analyst at Jefferies, said. Neither Google nor Microsoft provided a 2027 CapEx figure, but after Google upped its range for this year to $195 billion to $205 billion, analyst Yosef Squali of Truist Securities predicted it could reach $280 billion or higher next year, what he called scary territory. Zuckerberg portrayed Meta's lack of haste in monetizing its capacity as a matter of confidence. The company, he said, thinks it can ultimately do better by refining the raw material of silicon and electrons into finished products of AI models and apps, including the personal superintelligence he has been teasing for the last few quarters. "We believe there will be a higher margin on selling intelligence versus selling compute directly," he said. "Selling too much data center space now would provide the short term over the long term," he said. "And the benefit to investors of Zuckerberg's ironclad voting control is supposed to be that he can afford to focus on long horizons. I'm actually quite optimistic that we're going to see meaningful growth in all these areas," he added, "and I think we will have more to share soon on a number of them." But maintaining the confidence of markets has its own value. Alphabet was able to add nearly $90 billion to its AI war chest with an equity offering in June. It said it would use the money to build data centers and secure computing capacity. Meta, meanwhile, has been relying on debt to fund new data centers in Louisiana and Texas, and that debt is getting more expensive. Thill, the Jefferies analyst, summed up the Meta call. "It's like, well, we're not really going to give you a lot of details about the compute business. We're not going to tell you the ROI. We just need more compute, and you know, just trust us." And on to our next story. U.S. The daring mission to recover World War II POWs from the bottom of the ocean. The collapsed wreckage of the Oryoko Maru has made it impossible for the U.S. to bring home the remains of hundreds of Americans. Until now. By Mike Cherney. Petty Officer First Class Taylor Lucas was nearly 80 feet underwater inside the wreckage of a Japanese liner used to transport captured American soldiers and sailors in World War II. In the darkness, the U.S. Navy diver dug through mud, wood, and steel. There was so much sediment floating around that a flashlight was no use. Suddenly, he touched something that felt different. I got that feeling of like, oh, maybe this is something important, Lucas said. In his hand, he had the remains of a boot, sole and leather still attached. The shoe, later found to have U.S. Army written on the sole, was one of the strongest signs yet that Defense Department researchers are closing in on a goal that has escaped them for more than eight decades, bringing home the remains of about 250 American prisoners of war who died in December 1944 when U.S. aircraft in the campaign to retake the Philippines sank the Japanese ship carrying them. The mission at the Oryoko Maru, whose crumpled frame lies on the ocean floor about 500 feet off the Philippine coast, is among the most complex ever attempted by the Defense POW/MIA Accounting Agency, the Pentagon arm tasked with finding missing U.S. service members. For Christopher Schertz, it's almost the best hope yet to close a wound that has afflicted his family for three generations. Schertz's grandfather, Major Paul Schertz, died on the Oryoko Maru when he was 43. A U.S. postal worker in Deming, New Mexico, Paul was known for whistling while delivering mail. He also served as the choir director at a local church. When his National Guard Coastal Artillery Unit was deployed to the Philippines in 1941, just months before the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, Paul left behind his five-year-old son, Gerald, Christopher's father, and a one-year-old daughter, Jeanette. Paul's wife, Eleanor, was pregnant with another son, Robert, he would never meet. Christopher grew up hearing his father tell the story of their farewell at a train station in Fort Bliss, Texas. The loss of Major Schertz fined Gerald's life and influenced Christopher, too. Gerald, who died in 2023, joined the Army. Christopher became a history professor. I can't believe that after all this time, that would be something that would even be possible, Christopher said of his grandfather's remains, perhaps coming home. And I wish my dad was around to see it, because it meant everything. Searches, schematics, and surveys. About 80,000 U.S. service members remain missing, most of them from World War II. Locating and identifying these men and women is painstaking and sometimes dangerous. Even if the POW agency finds human remains, it may not yet have DNA from family members to identify them. Since 1973, fewer than 4,000 have been accounted for. In the case of the Oryoko Maru, there are the technical challenges of excavating the largely flattened 436-foot wreck, the sheer number of POWs, and the fact that researchers can't be certain who went down with the ship because of conflicting historical accounts. The agency has done underwater excavations before, but usually its researchers are looking for a single person or a small crew, such as aviators who went down with their aircraft. The Oryoko Maru is extremely damaged and extremely disarticulated, said Megan Mumford, the lead forensic underwater archaeologist for the mission. U.S. aircraft pounded the ship with rockets and bombs over 2 days in December 1944. In 1946, Navy divers used explosives to break open the wreck in an attempt to recover remains. Two disintegrating skull fragments were recovered. Ultimately, they decided the mission was too difficult and recommended the wreckage be designated a cemetery, like many other sunken World War II-era ships. It took decades before officials tried again. The turning point came when an effort to identify World War II remains tied to another Japanese transport ship led researchers back to the Oryoko Maru. Historians with the POW agency began combing through archives, including passenger rosters and survivor accounts, around the early 2010s. In 2016, a team started canvassing the area around the former U.S. Naval Base at Subic Bay, talking to local fishermen and divers about conditions at the site. Researchers eventually located schematics of the ship. More expeditions followed in which the POW agency and its partners conducted intensive underwater surveys to map the wreck and check on access to the ship's cargo holds. 7 main 3D models were created. The surveys confirmed the wreckage was the Oryoko Maru, and more importantly, that a recovery operation was feasible. The length of the ship matched the Oryoko Maru, as did features across the wreck. The front section, which was more intact, had an anchor, a windlass, and a stairwell feature consistent with the liner. Also visible was a hatch opening, leading to a forward hold where American POWs were believed to have been held. There are several ways we could approach the ship and get into the hold, which is down in the lowest part of the ship, Mumford said. The hellscape of the hell ship. On December 13, 1944, 1,619 Allied POWs, mostly Americans, were loaded onto the Oryoko Maru in Manila as the Japanese rushed to move prisoners to labor camps elsewhere before the Americans retook the islands. The ships also carried 1,000 merchant sailors, 700 civilians, and 100 crew, according to the POW agency, which notes the numbers are estimates based on conflicting historical documents. Many of the prisoners had been captured more than 2 years earlier when the Japanese first invaded the Philippines and had survived the infamous Bataan Death March. Many who survived the Oryoko Maru would later say their ordeal on board the ship, one of more than 100 Japanese prisoner transports that would become known as hell ships, was the worst of their captivity. In one cargo hold, prisoners sat jammed into the crotch of the man behind them, 5 to a row. Men passed out from suffocation and dehydration. Temperatures inside may have soared to 120. The Japanese requisitioned the ship, a luxury liner, for the war effort and had recently used it to transport horses. The ventilation system, turned on for the horses, was turned off for the prisoners. Some POWs said there were still traces of manure. Buckets, placed in holds as latrines, were soon overflowing. Hell is almost too small a word to describe what went on there, said John McManus, a historian at Missouri University of Science and Technology, who has studied the Japanese prisoner transports. Survivors talked about POWs drinking their own urine or going so crazy they attacked their comrades. To be able to lick a few drops of water off a rusty pipe became a leg up somehow, McManus said. That's just how mind-blowing and terrible this truly was. The hellscape worsened when U.S. aircraft attacked the Oryoko Maru on December 14th, one day after leaving port, and again on December 15, setting the aft deck ablaze and dealing the ship its final blows. Historians say U.S. commanders didn't know the ship was transporting American prisoners. Prisoners could hear the screams of Japanese children who were also on board. POWs who tried to escape were shot. Blood trickled down the structure of the ship, evidence of the carnage. Eventually, the Japanese abandoned the ship as it sank in Subic Bay, and the prisoners were forced to swim to shore. Just several hundred prisoners originally on board made it to Japan, with about 400 surviving to the end of the war, the POW agency estimates. Some 225 died during the Oryoko Maru's short journey and the U.S. attacks, according to the agency. An additional 55 drowned or were shot by the Japanese as they swam. Those prisoners who were recaptured were eventually loaded onto two more ships. More died when one of those ships was attacked by U.S. aircraft. Others died in transit. Paul Schurz's unit had become trapped in the Bataan Peninsula as the Japanese advanced. As the U.S. forces surrendered, Schurz left his position and approached the Japanese to make sure they knew hostilities had ended, saving his men. The act earned him the Bronze Star. Schurz then endured more than 2 years in Japanese prison camps. In the final moments of the Aruko Maru, an American military chaplain saw the lifeless body of Major Schurz, cradled his head, and said a prayer, according to Days of Anguish, Days of Hope, a book based in part on the diary of the chaplain who survived the war. Christopher Schurz believes it is a reference to his grandfather. His father, Gerald, served 28 years in the Army, rising to the rank of colonel. He tracked down veterans to learn more about his missing father and worked to ensure POW sacrifices were recognized. He told Christopher that his father's death felt like a big mix-up and that sometimes he would look down the street and imagine him walking home. As a child, Christopher would stare at photos of his grandfather, trying to imagine his voice and wondering what life would have been like if he had come home. Some years ago, he found some old family videos. He was stunned to see his grandfather appear on screen, holding his father's hand at the train station in Fort Bliss. There was also footage of the family waving goodbye. "I just couldn't believe what I was seeing," Christopher said. Here's this myth come to life. More human. During a more than two-month expedition that ended in early May, a team of U.S. Navy and Coast Guard divers, led by the POW agency, tried to make their way into the Aruko Maru's forward cargo hold, where 600 enlisted men were kept. The divers' base of operations was the USNS Salvor, a Citizen Mariner crewed salvage ship owned by the Navy. Pairs of divers connected to the surface via an air hose and audiovisual cables were slowly lowered into the water. Once under, they sliced through the ship's steel using a torch, with the self-consuming rod burning at thousands of degrees Fahrenheit. Hydraulic tools helped pry away heavier pieces of metal. It's very humbling to be down there and try to bring some of our fellow soldiers, sailors back home, said Chief Petty Officer Jason Friars, a U.S. Navy master diver. It's challenging, which is fun, and it can be scary at times because it's dark, but we're all kind of used to that. Diver's primary tool was a vacuum-like system called a dredge, which sucked up sediment from inside the wreck and deposited it into baskets on the sea floor. When ready, the baskets were lifted out of the water by crane and placed on a barge alongside the salvor, where researchers sifted through contents by hand. A key find was a second boot, this one with USA on the sole and a name carved into the leather upper. Another was a metal identification bracelet similar to a dog tag. Researchers also found a pair of broken glasses, an IV needle with a bottle topper, a brass item with writing, perhaps a cigarette case, and a button with Japanese-looking iconography. They also found ceramics and lots of chopsticks. When researchers found possible bone, they treated it like a forensic crime scene. They stored the item in water to keep it from disintegrating, marked down exactly where in the shipwreck it was found, and placed it in a locked case. Once in a lab, the objects will undergo a desalination process to make sure they're stable enough for further study. Of course, we're familiar with the history and the events, said Matthew DeFelis, another forensic underwater archaeologist with the POW agency. But then when an item comes up and it's this tangible piece of evidence, then it kind of makes it more human. A forensic review of the possible bone material with the Philippines was scheduled for July, though no results have been disclosed yet. The researchers plan to return in fiscal 2027 and hope to bring clarity to more families about their loved ones' final moments. Lori Zelensky's grandmother and mother rarely talked about her grandfather, Captain Fred Rose, who's listed among those unaccounted for on the Oruko Maru. The California firefighter and Army reservist had recently bought a house in Coronado with his wife before he was deployed to the Philippines in 1941. During the defense of the U.S. base at Corregidor in the bay near Manila, troops under Rose's command removed an artillery piece from its mount and turned it into a roving gun. They named it Battery Rose. He was given the Silver Star for his actions, but his death has remained a mystery. A 1951 letter from another POW said Rose was in the rear hold of the Oruko Maru when it was bombed. On another occasion, a visitor told Zelensky's family that he saw Rose in the water. Documents from the POW agency, meanwhile, state that he was in the forward hold. His wife, Marie Rose, never remarried and worked as a dental assistant. That family history, Zelensky said, marked her and her sister. My sister and I are both pretty strong women, said Zelensky, who had a long career in the computer industry. Around 2019, she found a box in the family home that had a picture of her grandfather. It was the first time she saw his face. Zelensky remembers having a dream as a child that her grandfather actually made it to shore. I've accepted it now, but as a kid, when I first heard the story, you kind of go, well, how do they know he died in the water? She said. How do you know he's not still alive in the jungle, like you hear about in Nam? You always have this dream that he'll come home. And on to our next story. Politics, policy. Two GOP senators force delay on Trump's attorney general pick. Committee holdouts want anti-weaponization fund formally killed and changes to no audits language before they will back Todd Blanche. By Richard Rubin, Sadie Gurman, and Lindsay Wise. A key committee vote to advance President Trump's nomination of Todd Blanche as attorney general was postponed as the administration made a last-minute pitch to win over holdout Republicans who could block the pick. The Senate Judiciary Committee had scheduled a vote Thursday on whether to send Blanche's nomination to the full Senate floor, but late Wednesday the committee said the vote would be postponed to provide more time to reach a deal. The delay came after Senators John Cornyn, R. Texas, and Tom Tillis, Republican North Carolina, warned they could vote against Blanche in the committee unless the administration permanently kills off a controversial $1.8 billion anti-weaponization fund. That fund was created in an agreement between Trump and his administration that ended the president's lawsuit against the Internal Revenue Service. The senators also want changes to a Blanche order that ended pending tax audits against Trump and his businesses and appeared to provide sweeping protections against government investigations. In a statement late Wednesday, a committee representative said the planned vote Thursday was postponed as work continues to secure sufficient support. The statement noted that Tillis and Cornyn wanted written assurances regarding Trump's IRS settlement. Asked hours earlier if he thought a deal might be close, Cornyn said no. It doesn't feel like it, he said. Bottom line is, we just need an executed agreement, said Tillis, who, like Cornyn, had a falling out with Trump and is leaving the Senate after this term. This is a fairly straightforward proposition, and we're almost there, too. He said only one provision remained a sticking point, and that the Justice Department was working toward revising a provision of the settlement agreement. We are working on getting a solution, said Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican Iowa, the Senate Judiciary Committee chairman, leaving a meeting in Cornyn's office Wednesday evening. A Justice Department official said Wednesday night that the department had transmitted new language to Cornyn and Tillis and were still in discussions. Blanche has been serving as acting attorney general since April, when Trump fired his predecessor, Pam Bondi. A single no vote from a Republican senator in the committee would effectively sink Blanche's confirmation to the permanent role, assuming all Democrats are opposed. Horan postponed a meeting with Blanche on Wednesday morning, saying he had made clear from the outset that he expected a written proposal to modify the audit actions that the Justice Department had given Trump alongside the IRS settlement. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Continuing on, Corwin said early in the day that the Justice Department had until 4 p.m. Wednesday to comply or Thursday's vote likely would be canceled. Maybe they think I'll just give up or go along, but they're mistaken, he said. The deadline passed with no deal. Senators John Kennedy, Republican Louisiana, a member of the Judiciary Committee, said he doesn't think Corwin is bluffing. John has every right to do it, and I think he's a good man. And if I were the Justice Department, I would believe him, Kennedy said. I think he's as serious as four heart attacks and a stroke and an ambulance. During his confirmation hearing this month, Blanche tried to ease senators' concerns over the settlement, which included the fund and a related order Blanche signed giving Trump sweeping legal protections from government actions. He said repeatedly that the Justice Department had abandoned the fund, but Corwin said he wasn't persuaded. The text of the deal created the fund, said that it could be changed only with agreement of all the parties who signed it, including the IRS, the Justice Department, and Trump in his personal capacity. Under sharp questioning by Corwin, Blanche said those entities hadn't altered the agreement and acknowledged that Trump could theoretically sue the government for a breach of contract for failing to create the fund. A related order also seized any pending tax audits of Trump, his family, and his businesses, and Blanche has said that prohibition remains in effect. That order said it applied to the plaintiffs in a lawsuit brought by Trump against the government and to related or affiliated individuals, including trusts and related companies. Under questioning from Corwin, Blanche said the order didn't apply to anyone beyond Trump, his two sons, and the Trump Organization, the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. Similarly, the written order said it applied to the defendants in the lawsuit, the IRS and the Treasury Department, and other agencies or departments. Pressed by Corwin about other agencies such as the Securities and Exchange Commission would be covered by the promise, Blanche said they wouldn't. Corwin said he wanted the Justice Department to make the written language mirror the more limited version that Blanche described in the hearing. That revised language could leave in place some audit protections for Trump. And on to our next story. World, Europe. France is using 12 aging planes to fight its wildfires. The water bombers, grounded often for maintenance, are prompting debate over the country's readiness ahead of blazes by Nomi Bisserby, Benjamin Katz, and Margarita Stancati. An aging fleet of water bombing planes, which have been grounded frequently for maintenance in recent days, has fueled a debate in France over whether the government was ready for some of the worst wildfires in decades. Opposition lawmakers have blamed French President Emmanuel Macron for failing to replace the country's 12 Canadair planes, which are decades old and serve as the vanguard of its aerial firefighting response. Last Saturday, as wildfires tore through pine forests in southwestern France, Canadair pilot Grégory Prats said only 5 of the planes were available to fight the fires. It's just outrageous, he said in an interview with France Info. We are facing fires of enormous intensity. Wildfires have ripped across parts of France and Spain. Firefighters in France have been battling an inferno in the region around the city of Bordeaux that has burned more than 100,000 acres, marking the area's largest blaze since a deadly fire in 1949. After wildfires ravaged southwestern France in 2022, Macron pledged to refresh the country's entire Canadair fleet and buy 4 more planes by 2027, aiming to have 16 new aircraft by the end of his presidential term. 4 years later, the government has ordered only 4. The first 2 aren't expected to arrive until 2028, with two more scheduled for delivery 4 to 5 years afterward. Its existing fleet includes planes that are 19 to 32 years old. The delay is partly because of a bottleneck at De Havilland Canada, the manufacturer of the plane, but France exacerbated the problem by cutting the funding intended to pay for two of the planes in 2024 in an effort to save money and reduce the government's burgeoning deficit. France put in a fresh order for two of the planes in June, but they have been pushed down the waiting list. "We have lost a crazy amount of time," said far-left lawmaker Damien Maudet, who co-wrote a parliamentary report last year urging the government to quickly review its Canada Air fleet. The French government has defended its firefighting effort, saying the Canada Air planes are just one of the tools it has at its disposal. Its firefighting fleet also includes Dash 8 water bombing planes, which can drop more than 2,600 gallons of water or fire retardant. Unlike the Canada Airs, which quickly scoop water from rivers or lakes, the Dash 8 has to be refilled on the ground. The French government has requested help from the European Union, which dispatched a fleet of 7 aircraft and 4 helicopters from Sweden, Portugal, and Germany, among other countries, and is hoping to get more help within the next few days. But France isn't the only country vying for these limited aerial resources. "We have deployed all the resources we could," Macron said on Monday. "Right now, we need to be united and take action," he added. French Interior Minister Laurent Nunez said on Monday that it was normal for the planes to require maintenance. "Every day you effectively have aircraft undergoing maintenance that we offset with rentals," Nunez said, adding that on Monday, 7 Canada airplanes were operational. The Canada airplanes are specifically designed for the particular challenges of fighting wildfires. They strike open bodies of water at high speeds to fill their tanks in seconds and pull up into unstable, superheated thermal air columns directly above raging fires, then head back to refill and restart the process. As these planes age, they can corrode and require increasingly complex, time-consuming maintenance to keep them flight-ready. De Havilland's new Canada Air 515, which is scheduled to roll off production lines in 2028, is a bid to revive the so-called Super Scooper amphibious aircraft that takes 12 seconds to refill its more than 1,500-gallon water tank. Production of an earlier model was halted in 2015 after previous owner Bombardier ran through its order book, delivering some 225 aircraft. About 160 of those are still in service. The aircraft isn't the only one of its kind, but its capacity, rapid refilling rate, and relatively small size have made it the cornerstone of European firefighting fleets. Countries often complement them with smaller scoopers, helicopters, and fixed-wing aircraft that carry higher loads but have to be refilled on land. The new model, which adds several upgrades, such as cockpit air conditioning, currently has 38 orders, 24 of which are from EU countries, according to Neil Sweeney, who heads government relations and corporate affairs for De Havilland. In total, the company expects to build between 250 and 350 at a rate of about 10 a year. As summers get longer and hotter, as climate change in the northern hemisphere, we're seeing fires in places they weren't before, Sweeney said. Demand right now is steady. This year may change that. The lack of firefighting capacity has left France trying to find alternative aircraft to help contain the blazes. That includes the first deployment of an A400M military transport aircraft to help with the emergency response. The Airbus planes cost about $170 million apiece and carry 4 turboprop engines. The plane maker, which has evacuated 2 of its sites near Bordeaux because of the wildfires, has provided French forces with prototype firefighting upgrades that were tested last year. The equipment enables the A400M to carry more than 5,000 gallons of water, all of which can be released in a single gravity drop maneuver and refilled in about 10 minutes back on the ground. The A400M is not an aircraft designed specifically for firefighting, but these aircraft are available, Airbus Chief Executive Guillaume Faury said on Wednesday, adding that the company had accelerated the A400M modifications to support the active firefighting efforts. We don't have a dedicated Canada Air-like firefighting aircraft, but we have worked to bring firefighting capabilities to the aircraft we have. France isn't the only country struggling with its aerial firefighting. In Spain, fires near Madrid have destroyed more than 190,000 acres, according to the country's Minister for Ecological Transition. Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez in May presented what he described as Spain's largest ever deployment of firefighting equipment ahead of this year's wildfire season. The response still fell short. Spain's firefighting fleet includes 15 water-scooping planes, reconnaissance aircraft, and helicopters. Those resources were focused in the fight against the fires that for days spread uncontrollably near Madrid, forcing about 100,000 people to evacuate or stay at home. Spanish firefighters have made progress over the past 2 days, stabilizing the blaze and allowing tens of thousands of people to return home. And on to our next story. Exclusive football. Michigan left out key details on probe into its athletic department. Details unearthed in a law firm investigation into a fired coach and the school's athletic culture weren't shared with the public, by Rachel Bachman and Corinne Rami. An investigation commissioned by the University of Michigan following the firing of football coach Sharon Moore highlighted problems inside the athletic department that went far beyond his intimate relationship with a staff member. Jenner & Block, the law firm Michigan hired late last year to investigate Moore and the broader culture inside the athletic department, called out the handling of controversies surrounding the previous football coach, Jim Harbaugh, and former men's basketball coach Juwan Howard in documents reviewed by the Wall Street Journal. The law firm laid out a series of potential red flags about Moore and outlined problems in Michigan's athletic department and other sports, including previously unreported issues with a water polo coach. Those findings contrast with what the university said in a recently released summary of the investigation. Michigan said that the law firm had not found widespread misconduct in athletics and didn't detail issues within other sports. The school released its summary after university officials viewed a slideshow with detailed findings prepared by the firm. That slideshow, reviewed by the journal, hasn't been released. Michigan paid the firm $12 million for the investigation. A Michigan spokesman said the school was focused on implementing recommendations stemming from the investigation and declined to comment on the substance of confidential interviews. The university has publicly shared the principal findings, recommendations, and actions resulting from those reviews, the spokesman said. In 2023, Michigan Athletic Director Ward Manuel and other officials began receiving complaints about abusive, unprofessional behavior by women's water polo coach Cassie Churnside, the law firm found. In 2024, parents complained, and the next year, two internal complaints were filed with the university office, according to the firm. Manuel's deputy sent Churnside at least two formal warning letters, and Manuel himself was notified that Churnside disregarded trainer's medical advice, the firm said. This past March, a Michigan news release said that Churnside had resigned. While there are improvements to be made, Ward consistently and appropriately engaged and shared information with professionals in the athletic department and within the university, including his supervisors and the Board of Regents, said Matthew Schenck, Manuel's lawyer. The law firm highlighted the school's response to the behavior of then-men's basketball coach Juwan Howard. The member of Michigan's famous 1990s Fab Five recruiting class came on as head coach in 2019 and led the team to the 2021 Big Ten regular season title. But in February 2022, Howard struck a Wisconsin assistant coach in a post-game confrontation. It was a shocking moment caught on live television. At the time, the Big Ten and Manuel jointly suspended Howard for the rest of the regular season, 5 games, and fined him $40,000. The law firm's slideshow labeled the incident one free punch. On December 7, 2023, Howard was involved in another incident, a verbal altercation with another coach, the law firm noted. The school didn't let Howard go until March 2024, after his team finished the season 8-24. Through his spokesman, Howard declined to comment. In football, the law firm noted warning signs that stretched across two coaching regimes. Under Jim Harbaugh, who led the Wolverines to the 2023 national championship, Michigan was involved in a massive sign-stealing scandal and recruiting violations. Harbaugh ran a program that was largely dismissive of rules compliance, the law firm quoted, from an August 2025 NCAA infractions report. Harbaugh has said he had no knowledge of any sign-stealing. He didn't respond to requests for comment. Through a spokesman, Michigan football's problems didn't stop when Harbaugh left after the 2023 season to coach the Los Angeles Chargers. The law firm highlighted that police investigated assistant coach LaTroy Lewis for a 2024 allegation of sexual assault. The status of the investigation, which first became became public earlier this year, is unclear. The accuser took out a protective order against Lewis. His lawyer said Lewis is innocent. The firm detailed numerous reputational risks about Moore that it said were known at the university. In March 2024, Moore's online interactions with an OnlyFans model were raised to school officials, according to the findings. The firm found that officials were aware of his social media likes of women, which showed up on an athletic department background check, and his overtures to a Michigan fan who posted scantily clad photos on social media. The firm included in its slideshow a photo showing Moore's car parked at the apartment complex of the staff member with whom he had the affair. Moore's lawyer didn't provide a comment. Although Jenner interviewed about 300 people, it couldn't compel people to talk, especially those not employed by the school. One notable example is Biff Poggi, who had 3 stints at the school as a football staff member and coached Michigan in the Citrus Bowl last December 31. After Moore was fired, Poggi called Michigan a malfunctioning organization in an interview. But when asked by Jenner and Blanc to participate in the investigation, Poggi declined. "I am not interested in speaking to you or anyone else," he wrote in a text message to the firm. "I've put Michigan in my rearview mirror and I'm keeping it there. I'm glad I'm gone." Poggi responded to a journal request for comment with a text message that said he was grateful to Michigan and glad to move on. And on to our next story. Artificial intelligence, the rise of million-dollar companies with just one employee. AI tools make it easier for founders to get started alone, and many stay that way as they grow. By Qipeng Chen. Ben Broca launched a company last December that offers AI tools to entrepreneurs. He's already added 10,000 paying customers and is on track to bring in $10 million in revenue this year. One thing he hasn't added, any other employees. The 40-year-old is part of a class of entrepreneurs who are launching and then often running new companies on their own. Artificial intelligence tools answer Broca's emails, help write and debug code, field requests from customers, sign up new subscribers, and grant refunds when issues arrive. Broca relishes his ability to make whatever decisions he wants on his own, often from his sun-drenched Sausalito, California living room. "I think compromises make lukewarm results. Once upon a time, running a business of a certain size required a team. AI is turning that assumption upside down and more aspiring entrepreneurs are going it alone. An analysis by the payments company Stripe shows there are thousands of solo operators on the company's platform that are generating over $1 million in revenue, with their ranks doubling between 2023 and 2025. The number of solo operators crossing the $10 million threshold nearly tripled in that same span. In the past, people without business contacts or particular savvy might not have known how to get their ideas off the ground, said Ernie Tedeschi, Stripe's chief economist. Now AI can be a built-in business partner, he said. AI's ability to handle various administrative tasks makes it potentially useful for launching solo businesses in many fields. But the technology's ability to also handle key tasks in tech, like coding, make that field a particular hotspot. Analyzing Census Bureau data, Bank Market Institute economist Taylor Bowley found that among all industries, new business applications in the information sector have seen the biggest percentage increase, nearly 45%, over the past year. At the same time, the rate of information sector applicants say they plan to hire workers has experienced the sharpest decline of any measured industry. This census data set doesn't track solo operated businesses, but the numbers broadly show, in tech and beyond, that applications are flat among businesses likely to hire workers, but generally rising elsewhere. Economists say that's a strong sign that solo operators are on the upswing. The bar for getting started has never been lower, said Julian Weiser, who runs a San Francisco-based accelerator for solo founders working in tech. The accelerator, which offers founders seed money and mentorship in exchange for an equity stake, attracted 4,500 applicants for 10 slots, made available in its most recent cycle, nearly five times the number it drew when it launched last May. Going it alone with AI can still be surprisingly expensive. Broca said he was losing money on many customers' accounts while paying to access Anthropic's Claude to run his clients' requests. That AI company, as well as others, charges based on usage. He has since switched to free open-source AI models from China. Broca said he has raised $30 million from investors, at the same time has saved millions in salary since he hasn't needed a team of software engineers. Another risk, it's easy for one entrepreneur to launch an AI-assisted business. Copying them can be easy too. This creates anxiety for founders like Troy Johnston, who runs an AI-assisted business alone in Orlando, Florida. Everybody has a sword and we all have the ability to unsheath Excalibur now, said Johnston, 40, who used AI to code an app that helps people get the most out of credit card benefits. The company makes around $3,000 a month in profit with no employees and is continuing to grow. What one-person businesses will mean for the labor market remains to be seen. Polling has shown Americans are worried that AI will replace jobs, and top economists are wrestling with that possibility too. But AI is also creating lots of new jobs, and the go-it-alone entrepreneurs show how the technology can both open doors and limit employment opportunities. If everyone's hiring less, but you get four times more firms, what does that do to headcount? Said Rembrandt Koning, an associate professor at Harvard Business School, who studies entrepreneurship. He co-authored a recent study that found that among 50,000 startups the researchers examined, those focused on AI tended to operate with 25% fewer employees. Koning also believes that a soft hiring environment that's left some people mired in long job searches has encouraged more to try their hand at launching businesses. Some founders cite different motives. It's a perfect storm of post-pandemic burnout and a reevaluation of one's priorities, and also booming AI and a sense of what's possible, said Samir Ahmad, 39, who lives in Brenningsville, Pennsylvania. 2 years ago, Ahmad decided to leave the corporate job he had worked at Verizon for almost two decades to start a solo coaching and consulting business. He had been seeing social media posts touting the ease and virtues of AI, which he used to chart a business plan and help with marketing. It was like my chief of staff, a second in command, he said. The business ultimately petered out within months, though, and Ahmad is now back to a full-time corporate role with a utility company. For Clairvaux, 41, AI helped her turn a passing impulse into a business. She was working full-time as a tech executive when she tapped AI in late 2023 to help code an app that would help her manage documentation and design for new products, with customers ranging from financial services to healthcare firms. I was copying and pasting from ChatGPT, said Vo, who lives in San Francisco. She put the app online for $1 a month, and within weeks, people downloaded it thousands of times. Nearly 3 years later, Vo's company, which she ran solo for 9 months before hiring an engineer, now has 100,000 users and is on track to make seven figures in profit this year. AI handles the company's marketing, sales, and customer support. While AI is a shortcut, Vo said her network and credibility in the industry were key. I think people over-index on how easy AI is and under-index on how much I did to get to this point, she said. Brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Cicely Tiernan, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.